We're in the Madison with 19 laps to go. Mark Cavendish and Bradley Wiggins currently trying to lap the field. That's what the noise is all about. And they're getting closer and closer. But will they have enough time? It's looking good. They're about to make the junction.
That's sensational. Just for the whole public, two of the greatest superstars in British sport. Amazing, absolutely amazing.
Did young Mark look better here than he did the Omnium?
Unbelievable, yeah. You know, it's just totally his turn of speed, his strength, Brad's endurance, unbelievable. Oh, I'm so proud of the boys, so proud of them.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, presented by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
My name is Duart Snow. I followed pro cycling for about 2 decades, but you have added a whole new depth and dimension to my understanding and enjoyment of the sport.
Hi, I'm Liz Miller. I download the podcast and take the guys to bed with me. Have to say, the husband is not amused when the bed often rocks with my laughter.
This is Spencer from Boulder. I let the exotic tales of faraway European races and the intrigue of insider gossip make me feel as though I'm there.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I am with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Lionel, Richie. Hello, is it me you're looking for?
Supposed
to carry on.
No, we're not supposed to carry on.
I think more than a couple of lines, and we have to pay rights to use
Rob
the music.
Hatch is our resident crooner, anyway, isn't he? I think.
Well, we've never heard him crooning on the
podcast.
Oh,
I certainly have. I can guarantee you.
Did you sing in the shower?
Frequently and loudly.
Okay, listen. Enough. We heard at the top, at the start of this podcast, we heard some noise from the Madison at the World Track Cycling Championships in London on Sunday, and that was Bradley Wiggins and Mark Cavendish winning the Madison. I happened to be standing beside Shane Sutton at the finish as they won the race and got some instant reaction from him. He was quite emotional. I did a bit of sort of attempted commentary while they were trying to gain a lap. I might have used the phrase "made the junction." You just heard that. I'm sorry about that.
Yellow card for that, I think.
Yeah, commentator cliches. Right, before we're going to talk about Strada Bianchi. We're going to talk about the World Track Cycling Championships. We've got an interview with Andy Sparks, the USA coach. But first of all, before any of that, Lionel, can you give us your weekly roundup, please?
Yeah, I'll keep it to the headlines this week. Race action, Le Samin, the one-day race in the French-speaking part of Belgium, was won by Nicky Terpstra of Etics Quickstep. Somewhat making up for their blank the previous weekend at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad and Koerner Brussels Koerner. Simon Clark, the Australian rider, won the Grand Prix Larciano. As you mentioned, Richard, the Strada Bianchi were the biggest two races of the weekend, really. Fabian Cancellara won on the dusty white roads of Tuscany for the third time in his career. And the world champion Lizzie Armitstead won the inaugural women's race, which is also the first round of the new Women's World Tour. We'll have a dispatch from Owen Rogers, who was there, a little bit later on in the programme. Paris-Nice and Tirreno-Adriatico, the World Tour stage races, got underway, and there'll be fuller discussion of those races next week. Probably the most excitement took place at the London Velodrome, the home of the Olympic Games, of course, and this year venue for the World Track Championships. The highlights among the Olympic events included a great win for Australia in the men's team pursuit, edging out a Great Britain team, which featured Ed Clancy just, 8-10 weeks after he had a back operation. The women's team pursuit saw a stunning victory for the USA. Jason Kenny won the sprint world title, proving that he is in great form around about once or twice every 4 years. Fernando Gaviria and Laura Trott won the respective Omniums. And of the non-Olympic events, there was a memorable points race win for Great Britain's John Dibben. And the championships closed, as you heard a little bit before, with a sensational Madison victory for Mark Cavendish and Bradley Wiggins. Away from the races, we've heard this week that Bernard Hinault will be retiring from podium duty at the Tour de France at some point. Some speculation that this year's Tour will be the last for him. The UCI has announced that 21 events from four continents have applied for World Tour status from 2017 onwards. We can only assume that some of those races don't yet exist. These may well be new races to the World Tour calendar. And as if to serve as a riposte to the UCI's plans, ASO has announced that there will be a return for the Deutschland Tour or the Tour of Germany, probably from 2017 onwards.
Good news, isn't it, Daniel?
It is, it is. It could also be a shot fired across Velon's bows and the UCI's bows, couldn't it?
Could. We actually went and met with Graham Bartlett last week from Velon, chief executive of Velon, and we'll be playing that interview very soon. He's a very interesting guy. First time I'd met him. I met him a couple of days later at the World Track Championships. But yeah, an interesting development in that ongoing story.
Yeah, and it is, as you said, Rich, a positive development as far as Germany is concerned. As we know, they've had 10 pretty nasty years, 10 anni horribili,
now,
if you will.
We discussed this earlier, Daniel, I'm pretty sure you said annus horribilises.
I mangled that. No, first I said annus mirabilis, and then I graduated to annus horribilis, and then finally
horribili.
I got something like the right Latin plural. Anyway, yeah, it's been 10 very difficult years, or around 10 very difficult years for German cycling, and it's a bit of a resurgence. And this latest news, the return of the D-Tour, the Deutschland Tour, confirms that. We've had German team, well, a German World Tour team registering. We've had a very good few years for German riders. Races, unfortunately, are still disappearing. The Bayern-Rundfahrt won't take place this year. But we're going to have a national tour of Germany, it looks like, from next year, which is excellent news.
Pretty much the ideal time to plan a move to live on a more permanent basis in Germany, for one of us, perhaps.
Possibly.
Breaking news. We've got I think we're going to do a friend special on Germany and German cycling, the resurgence of Germany. I spoke to Marcel Kittel recently about his and John Degenkolb's efforts to get the Tour de France back on German TV, the meetings they had, etc. Very interesting insight, so stay tuned for that. Before we get on to other business, we should talk about Strada Bianchi, which is a relatively new but feels like a very old race, and I think one of our favourites. Beautiful race. I watched it without commentary, which wasn't a choice, but I quite enjoyed it without commentary. No offence at all to commentators. In fact, could have done with them in the closing stages, but it really felt like you were there. You could hear far more from the riders themselves, of the fans at the roadside, even the tyres on the white dust of Tuscany. And it is such a beautiful race to look at. Perhaps the only sort of bum note, if you like, is the finish in Siena, which is stunningly beautiful to look at. But they have got the 18% climb up into the old town, and then the finish comes very quickly. And it's, for those watching there live, it can be a little bit of a damp squib.
And it's also very difficult to overtake, isn't it, there, Rich? I mean, we saw Cancellara lead it in, and Stibar looked at one point as they might certainly want to take, he certainly did want to overtake Cancellara, but couldn't really get round him, and Cancellara kind of hogged the road. Another barren weekend for Etix Quickstep, but they've certainly got a lot of riders in excellent form. Gianluca.
They animated the race.
That's another absolute. Nails on the blackboard.
Until they made the junction up.
Anyway, and where was the moto at any point? Was the moto taking riders out at any point? Anyway, Etix Quickstep, power in numbers yet again. Brambilla, Gianluca Brambilla, who's a rider who's kind of gone under the radar the last couple of years. And
apart from when he punches people.
Yes, but otherwise has rattled off a number of very impressive performances. It was very good in the Vuelta last year. It was right on the fringes of the top 10. But Strade Bianche is a strange race, isn't it? It's very difficult to predict, very difficult to know what kind of rider he's going to be the front.
Yeah, Cancellara has won it three times, so it's clearly a race that suits him. But you see such a variety of riders up there. It's a bit like Milan-San Remo in that respect. It seems to suit. You know, Valverde was up there. Nibali was up there for quite a
Nibali,
while.
Nibali, who I found out today, lost his virginity at age 17. He told an Italian magazine in an interview that he lost his virginity at age 17.
I mean, that's probably sounds quite standard to me.
It's
nothing remarkable about that.
Not really remarkable or intriguing. Very gratuitous. Gratuitous of the magazine to ask it. Very gratuitous of me to mention it in the podcast.
Extraordinary.
I don't know how to follow that, really. I mean, he didn't look.
He we really need Chiro at this point. Of course, Chiro, of course, knew that already.
He was probably there. Just okay. over the shoulder. Okay,
compose got, ourselves. Anyway.
Okay, got to rein this in. Got to rein this in. Valverde looked extremely good. Kwiatkowski, maybe not quite back to his best after illness. But Stibar, Cancellara. Who else was it? Peter Sagan. Of course he was there. Where else would he be but in the break?
Sagan yet again falling short at the end of a big, hard race. And it's a bit of a mystery, isn't it? Because you can't say that it's down to distance. We talked about that last week, didn't we? About how Sagan was still struggling in the finales of hard races. Strade Bianche is a very difficult race, but it's not long. And again, he just seemed to lack punch.
Does he mind? I mean, Mark Cavendish mischievously suggested in our little chat with him last week that that coming second is quite being seen as quite a cool thing. The thing is, it doesn't affect his popularity, does it?
No,
if anything, it enhances
in fact, it's
it.
Enhanced it. I mean, he has been called the Slovakian Pulidor, hasn't he, at times? And well, just by me about 10 seconds ago. But Raymond Poulidor, of course, famous for always being the bridesmaid in the Tour de France, never having the yellow jersey. But yes, Sagan has developed this habit, and he's taken on the mantle of Greg Van Avermaet, really, hasn't he? Who was also up there. And it occurred to me earlier today, I was looking back at BMC's previous classics results. BMC sort of really became one of the super teams on the world stage in about 2010-11 and made heavy investment in the classics, and they really need to win a monument this year, I think, because they have not won one so far. So pressure's on Greg Van Avermaet.
They've never won a monument.
Never won a monument.
Philippe Gilbert he's won Amstel Gold Race and BMC Cos, but he hasn't won Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
At BMC, no.
Wow. Interesting. No, that's what I meant. Fabian Cancellara, though, I mean, his final year, we can follow his progress on the Eurosport series. Follow Fabian, a behind-the-scenes sort of documentary voiced by a friend of the podcast, Rob Hatch, isn't it?
Podcast favourite crooner, Rob Hatch.
Yep. But Cancellara does look sharp and strong, and it's almost hard to believe that he's just going to walk away at the end of the sport because he looks back to his best.
Yeah, and there's a real sense, or there's a real touch of the Bernard Hinault's about the way he's going about this year. And Bernard Hinault, as you know, Richard, because you wrote an acclaimed and very good book about Bernard Hinault's last Tour de France, 1986 Tour de France. And Hinault has always maintained, and this is very topical because Hinault, of course, is stepping away from his ASO duties. That's how it seems. Hinault talked about how in the 1986 Tour de France, his last Tour de France, he simply wanted to have fun. And he wanted to almost treat bike racing as a game. And that was certainly how he looked as though he rode that Tour de France. And Cancellara has talked in a similar vein in interviews over the winter about wanting to rediscover some of the spirit he had when he was a young rider and didn't really have any cares or anxieties or pressures. And really just wanted to go out and enjoy himself, and he looks to be doing that so far this year. Won a very difficult race in or stage or fragment of the Challenge Mallorca earlier this year, and Strade Bianche really rode with some abandon, didn't he?
Little shout out for Teish Benoit, who we featured in last week's podcast. We had a little interview with the 21-year-old Belgian who was up there in Het Nieuwsblad, and clearly a rider in great form and with great promise. Let's hear a little bit from the women's Strade Bianche, because it was the first event on the Women's World Tour, a bit of history made. So we thought we should get some kind of report from it. We were lucky that Owen Rogers, freelance journalist, was there, and we asked Owen if he could record us a little dispatch. He did that, and also got a little interview with the winner, Lizzie Armistead. So here that is now.
I'm here in Il Campo, which is the finishing point for the women's elite Strade Bianche, which is the first round of the Women's World Tour. Currently the riders have about 10k's left to ride, and we have a group of three, Lizzie Armistead, Cassia Nieriodoma and Emma Johansson, who have a gap of about a minute with, as I say, about 10k's left to go. We'll see what happens in the next 20 or so minutes. We're here at the finish of the women's World Tour race in Strada Bianca, and Lizzie Armitstead has just won the race. She's pulling up alongside us and stopping at the top of the road. Two races this year as world champion and two wins. A remarkable, remarkable success for Britain's world champion. I'm here at the finish with Lizzie Armitstead. Lizzie, you now have a 100% record in the rainbow jersey. Was it the plan for you to lead today?
No, not really. Obviously, you come to every race and you want to win. But today was about the team win, and not specifically me. I just had good legs and I was in the right move at the right time. And I'm really proud of the way the team rode. And individually, it's just it's really nice, obviously, to win. And like you say, it's a bit of a historic race. Hopefully, it's going to be the start of something big in women's cycling. So I'm happy that I've got the first tick, I suppose.
What were your thoughts when you made the break with Cassia and Emma?
I thought this is a good group. Yeah, this should work. We should work together well but Emma Johansson wasn't working, which was pretty frustrating, but to be honest, I think she didn't have the legs anyway, so it was between me and Cassia. And I knew that Cassia is a seriously strong climber, but she maybe didn't have the punch over me in the final, so I thought this is a good move.
How did the final climb go?
Well, it was a bit of poker all the way through the last kilometre really, but Cassia cracked first and went for it. She went for a long one, which, you know, was her best option really, so I just knew that I had to hang on that back wheel as long as possible. And then I took over with about, I don't know, 400 metres to go.
Next week at Drenthe, I presume you're racing in Drenthe, you'll be wearing the Women's World Tour leaders jersey as opposed to that beautiful rainbow jersey. What do you think about that?
I think we have to check that rule, maybe. I don't know. I think the rainbow should trump it, but either way, I'm obviously very happy and proud. As long as my sponsors are printed on it, then it's a good day.
The World Tour is obviously a very, very long season. Do you think it's possible for one rider to target the World Tour and successfully?
Oof, good question. We'll see, I suppose. I mean, particularly in the Olympic year, it's not something I'm going to focus on, no way. I mean, I need to kind of have those dips in form to be able to have those peaks. So it depends on the kind of rider. I think somebody like Anna van der Breggen would be very good at that. Somebody like Megan in our team as well, she's consistently good. She's good in stage races, but it's not something that I'll be targeting.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for sponsoring Cycling Podcast again this year. They are broadcasting live Paris-Nice, which finishes on the 13th, that's Sunday, and Tirreno-Adriatico, which goes on till the Tuesday, the Italian stage race, which leads us up to Milan-San Remo on the 19th, coming next week. That's coming very soon, so we'll be previewing that next week, but you'll find all of those races on Eurosport.
Any bets yet, Rich? Milan-San Remo?
Not really a betting man, Daniel.
Talking to friend of the podcast Daniel Lloyd the other day.
Well, he is a betting man.
He is very much a betting man about who he fancied for Milan San Remo. Ramunas Navadauskas, there's a name for you. 125-1 as we're
not a bad show, maybe.
Well, I won on Milan San Remo last year.
Milan San Remo.
I backed John Degenkolb, and I also won the year before. I backed Alexander Kristoff.
Wow.
Good odds both times. So
So who are you tipping? Like?
Well, I'm going to wait until maybe see how the form goes in Tirreno, Adriatico and Paris-Nice, and then look at the odds. I often go by the odds, really, where the best value is, rather than just sort of picking off victories. I'd rather win big and spectacular. Than
I think Filippo Pozzato is going to turn back the clock.
Well, judging by the fact that Pozzato was outside the time limit of the weekend at Strade Bianche, and
he's just keeping his powder dry.
Yeah, and not even greatest friend of Filippo Pozzato, Ciro Scognamiglio, who I just spoke to a few minutes ago, is particularly optimistic about Pozzato's spring campaign. So
I got laughed at last year for mentioning Sylvain Chavanel in connection with Milan-San Remo. Now, he's going well. He's going really well. Rode well in Paris-Nice. He's got a win already, and he rode well in the Paris-Nice prologue, and I think he's going extremely well. But I'm not saying he's going to win it. I'm just saying it's a race where he has animated,
I think if the
which
finish line was between the Cipressa and the Poggio, he would have a chance because he has been off the front on numerous occasions there and always been caught.
Let's talk about the World Track Cycling Championships. I should just say quickly, thank you very much to Owen Rogers for sending us a report from the Strade Bianche for Women. Hopefully we'll cover more of the Women's World Tour this year. That's certainly the plan. So we were all at the Velodrome at various points. I was there throughout. Daniel, you were there. You were spotted loitering. Did you enjoy it?
Yep.
Did you enjoy it, Daniel?
No, I did actually. I think one of my problems with track racing over the past few years has been the fact that, to my eyes, it's looked like a mismatch between Team GB and pretty much every other nation. The resources that the Team GB are investing in track cycling absolutely dwarf the kind of money available to other nations. And, you know, the successes have been rightly celebrated in Great Britain. However, it seemed to me that it hasn't really been a level playing field. And I am glad to see that some of the balance seems to have been redressed. People have caught up. The margins, we talk a lot about margins and marginal gains, but the margins of advantage for the British team in terms of their technology, bikes, etc., seem to be smaller than they were a few years ago.
I think the Italians were a big surprise. You know, they rode extremely well in the team pursuit. And young Filippo Ganna, 19 years old, he signed for Lampre last year. I mean, he was phenomenal. And one of the highlights for me of the 5 days, actually, was the atmosphere during the pursuit. It was an Italian against a German, a very partisan crowd, you know, fair enough. But the crowd really got behind into that race because he was well down, Ganna. And he did what he'd done in previous rounds, which was to start very, very slowly. I think he was 19th or 13th quickest or something in the first half of his semi-final, and then obviously recorded the fastest time. And he came from quite a long way back and just put in a storming finish, and the crowd were on their feet.
Yeah, the Italians have not had a particularly good time on the track over the last 10 years or so, largely due to lack of resources, but also because they've really seen the track as a discipline apart and bearing no relation to the road. And what they've started to do is realise that track cycling and good results and good training and good facilities in track racing can really help the road. And the velodrome, the only covered velodrome in Italy, has been built in Monte Chiari between Brescia and Verona. An awful lot of road professionals are using that now, but it's also clearly hugely benefited the track team. And they also have a very committed coach, Marco Villa, who was one of the sort of stalwarts of Italian track cycling for many years, but he seems to have taken that on and doing a really good job.
A few questions were asked, I saw on social media, about Ganna's apparent improvement from the Italian National Championship. I think he took 10 seconds off his best time. I was going to try and find him. I don't know if he speaks any English, but could have done with you at that point. Daniel, I couldn't see him after the day after his pursuit win. There could be all kinds of reasons for that. 10 seconds is not
not
a miraculous.
He's 19 years old, so, you know.
He's 19 years old. We don't know what condition.
For improvement. That age is quite.
Let's leave him to answer the question, shall we? Because we will at some point. He's clearly a great prospect. But for a lot of people, I mean, it's from a British point of view, it got off to a very slow start, very disappointing start, and it kind of built up. It was a bit like the kind of Ghana's pursuit was a sort of microcosm of the British performance over 5 days, and it came to quite a thrilling climax with the Madison, and, you know, a non-Olympic event. But you think you and I were there in 2008, Lionel, in Manchester, when Wiggins and Cavendish, as they pointed out afterwards, before they'd really done anything on the road, they won the world title there, and it was a very similar type of race. The final 50-40 laps, they finally got the lap that they'd been looking for. And, you know, they were trying and trying and trying on Sunday, and finally they got the break, and they got away, and they had the Spaniards for company and for help, which was extremely useful. I think there were warm embraces at the end with the Spanish team. And they got it, and they had enough points to win the race. And it was, you'd have to have a heart of stone not to have enjoyed that, and you'd find yourself swept up a little bit in the atmosphere, because it did raise the roof.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't there on the Sunday, but I did watch it in a hotel room in France. They were showing the track championships live on French television, and even the French commentators were sort of swept away by how impressive Cavendish and Wiggins were. And it was very similar to their ride in 2008. The difference being that in 2008, there was this sense that it was a real dress rehearsal for the Olympic Games in Beijing, whereas now the Madison is not part of the Olympic programme. However, in terms of Mark Cavendish's goals on the track in Rio later on this year, I think that Madison performance was really important, because after his result in the Omnium, when he finished sixth, a little way off the medals, you know, the medals slipped away in that final points race, where he might have expected to make up ground. In actual fact, you know, he sort of trod water, really. There's a lot of talk that that was Cavendish's chance blown, and particularly in light of John Dibben's very impressive performance in the points race. But I think the most important thing to recognise from those respective performances is that John Dibben was riding in a points race field that was not the absolute A1 of track riders, because all of the riders who will be focusing on the Omnium were riding the Omnium in London, the Fernando Gaviria and Elia Viviani, to name just two of them. So, you know, you have to take Cavendish's performance in the context of, you know, what the winter's been. And as he mentioned to you, Richard, in last week's podcast, you know, he clearly wanted to make that point that he feels he can be a part of that team pursuit group. And I wouldn't say the door is shut for him by a long chalk yet.
I think most observers, myself included, thought that Cavendish looked much better in the Madison than he had done over the 2 days of the Omnium. He looked to me sluggish in the Omnium in all the events. Rode quite well in the elimination race, but other than that, Gaviria was, you know, just unbeatable. That guy had such a turn of speed that nobody could live with him. Viviani looked good as well, but Cavendish just didn't seem to have it. And in the Madison, now there could be all kinds of reasons for it. I'm sure Mark would tell us. But in the Madison, to me, he looked much better. He looked strong and he looked fast. And I actually put that to him afterwards. I said to him, do you think you were better in the Madison than you were in the Omnium? And he paused for a bit, as he does. He looked at me. He narrowed his eyes and he said, no. And I said, well, I thought you looked a bit zippier in the Madison. And here's what he said.
Yeah, I was strong in the Omnium, Richard. Like, come on. Like, I was zipping. Look how many points I won.
So I think Mark agreed with me that he was zippier in the Madison than the Omnium. And there, you know, he might be right. He'll know better than me, but my my feeling was that he was probably a bit disappointed in himself that he didn't show. And you know, it kind of backs up the argument that he's been making all along, which is that he'll be better with more racing, that he'll come out of the Tour de France a better Omnium rider than he is now.
Can I ask a track cycling layman's question?
Of course, Daniel, fire away.
We all know, or we have discovered, that the rider who represents a nation, in this case GB, in the Omnium, has to take part at some point in the team pursuit. Could Mark Cavendish, if he's selected for the Omnium, could he not simply ride the first round of the team pursuit, go off potentially first, only do a couple of laps, 2, 3, 4 laps, I don't know. How long's a lap in track cycling? It's about 250 metres, isn't it?
It's about 250 metres.
Anyway,
meters, yeah.
Could he and simply leave the other three to probably do enough to beat whoever their opponents are and then not have to worry about the team pursuit for the rest of the Olympics?
Well, technically, he could ride the road race and he could do the first 50 kilometres fetching bottles and doing a bit of teamwork and then just ride the Omnium. I mean, that's what, I forget now which French rider it was who did that in 2012, but a French track rider did about 2 miles of the road race.
A sprinter?
Yeah.
Was a sprinter.
Really should remember his
was
name,
it
but
Kevin Searle, was it?
Sure, I can't remember who it was. But so there's all sorts of permutations. That's why I'm saying, you know, the team pursuit door doesn't necessarily have to be open for him to get into the Olympics. But as he said to Richard in our additional episode last week, you know, he feels that he's got something to offer the team pursuit, and he has done all that work on over the winter. The thing about zippiness in the Madison, Richard, the other thing to bear in mind is that gear selection between a points race and a Madison will be different. So, you know, the legs, it's a fixed gear, obviously, so, you know, speedier looking legs in the Madison to some of the other events. That might account for the impression you had, but certainly I'd agree with you. You know, he wasn't matching the top guys in the Omnium, whereas
well,
in the Madison...
Well, you heard at the start, I asked Shane Sutton the question, he seemed to agree that he did look better. And, you know, Cavendish, in every stage race he does, he tends to get better, doesn't he? I mean, the Giro, the Tour, he often...
He did say that he felt good in the... He started to feel good in the points race in the Omnium, and he was merely carrying over the form that he'd had on Saturday into the Madison. What do you chaps think about the decision he seems to have made that he wants to ride the Olympics and he wants to do the Omnium and he wants to presumably sacrifice an awful lot of his road racing season for that goal?
Well, Shane Sutton's already come out in the last couple of days. Well, hang on, and said that he expects Mark Cavendish to do perhaps the first 10 to 14 days of the tour, and I think that says it all. And really, Mark Cavendish is, his performances on the road, do warrant him having the choice. He has that big gap, as we talked about in last week's episode. He has that big gap in his list of honours, and he wants an Olympic medal, and I think he's done enough to earn the right to choose to go for that, particularly if his team are willing, Dimension Data are willing to accommodate him chasing it. It's by no means a given, though. I mean, we've said 2008 and 2012, we fully expected Mark Cavendish to win a gold medal.
Yeah, as Mark Cavendish made clear in the Kilometre Zero chat that we had last week, it's only 1 year, and he is only 30. We because he has appeared to be a, in inverted commas, fading force, as we described Andre Greipel last year, is older, of course. He's only 30, and it's maybe too soon to write him off. He'll be 31 next year, or he'll be 31 this year.
He'll be
31 this year. But, he's still, you would think, he's still got 2 or 3 or 4 years left at the top.
But only one Olympics, probably.
But only one Olympics. So, therefore, is it worth a gamble? It possibly is.
As far as the Tour de France is concerned, I think he has one very, very clear objective and one objective only, and that's the first sprint at Mont-Saint-Michel. He wants to take the yellow jersey. That's another gap in his palmarès at the moment. And I know that he's already doing work on that particular sprint, already looking at videos. And I think the way he's going to approach that sprint is quite similar to the way that Wiggins and other riders in the GB Sky setup have approached races and big challenges before, i.e. he's going to know exactly how many watts he has to produce for how long, exactly where he's going to launch his sprint, etc., etc. So I think he's really going to plan that down to the finest detail.
A word on Gaviria, who looked very impressive. I did an interview with him after. He doesn't speak English, but somebody very kindly translated, a podcast listener, so thank you. Didn't catch your name, but thank you very much for your help with that. Gaviria may ride the Vuelta. I said to him, is that your priority this year? And he said, no. Of course, he rides for Etix Quickstep, and Patrick Lefebvre wasn't a big fan of Cavendish devoting much time to the track. So I wonder how supportive he is of Gaviria, who's a much younger rider, and a lot cheaper, but also in his first year and really sort of here to gain experience. He did look phenomenal. I mean, the guy has got incredible acceleration, real impressive turn of speed. He came off in the Madison at one point, jumped straight back up. Cavendish also came off and got back, and there was quite a funny moment where Wiggins was asked about that, and it was just after they'd made the junction, and they were on their last legs, and you forget that because it looks like a fairly smooth effort.
That's
but you forget,
a bit odd, isn't it? In the Madison, the way people can crash and their partner just carries on from the other side of the track, isn't that a bit odd?
Why is that odd? Cavendish crashed when he was coming down for the changeover. So Wiggins just carried on. But Wiggins didn't seem to realise he'd crashed. And he said, I was looking around for him. I was thinking, where's he gone? So he couldn't see him. He is quite small, but he was back up pretty quickly and they held on. But that was a sticky moment.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
So, Richard, you were in the London Velodrome all week, keeping your eye on the racing. What else caught your eye?
Well, Laura Trott, as ever, 3 gold medals she won. Phenomenal. A real crowd pleaser. She didn't win the elimination race for once. Sarah Hammer won that. But she was her usual self. She's one of these riders who seems to draw a lot of energy from the crowd, and there's a real connection between her and the crowd. I've said it many times before. Jason Kenny, the great enigma, emerged from hibernation to win the sprint and looks good for the Olympic Games. But the story that really caught my attention was the American Team Pursuit victory in the women's Team Pursuit. I spoke to Andy Sparks, their coach, a few months ago for a story I was writing. And, he explained at the time just how few resources they have, how little money they have. US Olympic Committee is the only Olympic Committee in the world that doesn't get any government funding at all. So they're entirely reliant on sponsorship. And it's quite a story, really, and what he's created there, a women's team pursuit team built around his wife, Sarah Hammer, The other riders on the team are all very, very young. Chloe Dygert, who double world champion from Richmond, junior world champion last year. Jennifer Valente and Catelyn Kelly. Evelyn Stevens, of course, another endurance rider in the USA who recently put the world air record, but I don't think she's in the reckoning for the team pursuit. But anyway, it's a great story. So I sat down with Andy Sparks on the final day of the World Championship, just asked him how he'd done it.
So Andy, I spoke to you a couple of months ago, and you know, it's fairly clear that you're working with fewer resources, less funding than a lot of teams here, but I guess you can reflect on a really positive World Championship.
Yeah, and I mean, when we last spoke, you know, asserting the position that we're always searching for, you know, our unique American solution. At the end of the day, for all the coaches out there, it's sort of a problem-solving position, given everyone, no matter what team you're on, of giving out a finite amount of resources, a finite amount of staff. You know, all the coaches wouldn't be in those positions if they just were going to give up with what they had. We all do the best, so it's sort of relative to each sort of program. In the U.S., we have exponentially less money than other programs that we're up against. So since we last spoke, really just pushing a program with high standards, pushing a system where we try to really promote the best possible team as far as pushing the thought to where we need to be stronger than 4 to 5 collective individuals. When we come together, we need to be stronger as a team. That's really since the last 4 to 6 weeks now that we've collected sort of our Olympic team of really what we're sort of like, say, pushing to where, you know, all things being equal, it's for us versus another country, we need to be stronger in those little 1% categories and all those little 1% areas. For us here at the World Championships, I would say for our girls, say they exceeded expectations. I would say that's backed up against some teams that, you know, have had some bad luck and have been below expectations.
A team gold medal must mean more than an individual gold medal because it is a product of teamwork and a certain culture, I suppose. You're working with very young athletes, with the exception of your wife, of course, who's the experienced rider on the team, but the others are very, very young indeed. How have you managed to get them up to this level so quickly, performing so well as a team?
For me, I've had a lot of individual riders win world championship medals and jerseys, but for sure the most meaningful world title I've ever won as a coach was a team, and I've never really had a team event to where we started from scratch. I mean, so even the next morning I woke up and I was like, wow, that is just really satisfying. So I mean, I woke up with a smile on my face. So it's so different. I've spoken with a lot of the other coaches, Shane Sutton and Gary Sutton, and it's just such a different experience. I mean, where it's like I feel really through this experience, and even the last 2 months really, to where we went from team to family. And of course, when the family goes through good times, bad times, but it makes everyone stronger. And even when Sarah crossed the line when they won in the team pursuit, she was just emotional because she's never won sort of a team title. They've won a silver medal in the Olympics, of course, but just really satisfying on a next level. And I think, as always, you know, enjoy working hard for other people and taking care of other people and trying to get the best opportunity for other people. It was incredibly awesome. I think as far as managing our young riders compared to other teams, because minus Sarah, all of our riders are really under 21 years of age or younger. We've got Chloe Dygert, who this was literally her second track race. We've got Jennifer Valente, individual silver medals last year. So all of our riders are really, really young. And my goal is really to put them around Sarah as like a mentor athlete as much as possible, because the reality is, you know, we might only have Sarah for another year. So the more that she can bring up the Jens, the Chloes, the Kellys, to where they see, hey, here's the champion standard. And at the end of the day, what we'll say is, you know, she's not here forever, and you guys are going to be the next ambassadors, and you have to carry that tradition. So that's really what we push to really maximize the time that we have Sarah, have her around the girls as much as possible, really build our sort of culture of excellence to where in the U.S. is what we're looking for, is to build something with a legacy factor, not just a result here or there.
You pushed for a long time for a covered velodrome in Colorado Springs, where you're based. You've got that now. Are we seeing some of the fruits of that, or will those come later?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think this is the first result to speak to that project of all of our team that won the World Championships here, and once again, the first ever for U.S. cycling and team pursuit. That's a result of having a centralized model based out of Colorado Springs, because once again, that's where the strength of our infrastructure lies. We've got the USOC support. We have USA Cycling based out of Colorado Springs. We have an excellent cycling community in Colorado Springs and Colorado as a whole. So it's once again promoting that family-like atmosphere. We have just a lot of support out there, and even a lot of support that we draw upon, whether it's the USOC or community level. That's where our strength is, and the result, you know, once again, making history. And the one and largest variable is having now an indoor velodrome. The cover on the Colorado Springs track has been a complete game changer, and that's, you know, thanks to a lot of people, USA Cycling, the Development Foundation, the USOC. So really, once again, everyone working together to make history and accomplish some awesome goals.
And just finally, Andy, a lot of excitement about Chloe Dygert. She's very young. She's multiple world champion now. How good can she be?
Personally, I think that she could be the best ever in U.S. cycling. I mean, her physiological attributes and gifts are just nothing short of remarkable. She grew up in the same state that I grew up in America. It's Indiana, and it's really a blue-collar state. She has the perfect balance of the physical attributes, but also the mental attributes of being raised by a family that taught her to work hard, high-level appreciation. During the summer, she would actually mow grass. So she has everything she needs to be successful and really, I feel, the best ever American cyclist. And thankfully now I have a great collection of five very, very talented riders that I would take over anyone else in the world. So
are we talking best ever American cyclist, male or female, or female?
I feel the best cyclist in general ever, and that's not just a track cyclist, that'll be a road cyclist as well. So I think when we look at best all-time cyclists, Rebecca Twigg, I put her in that category. Sarah, at these World Championships, she actually became the most successful U.S. cyclist ever with eight World Championship titles. So now she leads that category as most world titles. But Chloe, I think, long-term, she'll be a cash register of world titles, so whether that's road time trial. I think the road racing efficiency is a big part. She'll have to learn a little bit more of that. But anything that's going to be a power-based sport, road time trial, I think she's enjoying her time at the track, so I think, she'll continue on with that. I could definitely see team pursuit, individual pursuit, even Omnium, because she has, some great gifts across the board and really all those energy systems we look for success. So, yeah, great, great things and a great collection of young women now, so we're excited for the future.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool. Pair your power meter with over 800 workouts and 80 training plans to make you a faster cyclist. Visit trainerroad.com/TCP to try Trainer Road risk-free for 30 days.
Must say a big thank you again to Trainer Road, who've been fantastic sponsors throughout the winter. We're building up to our race on March 29th in Manchester, Lionel. But no, thank you. A big, big thank you to Trainer Road. They have helped us to bring you this podcast free weekly. If anybody else is out there is interested in sponsoring the podcast, get in touch. We're several packages coming up, haven't we? But how's the Trainer Road training going, Lionel? I mean, I must say I've had a bit of a sticky patch. I've been struggling a bit.
Yeah, I've been on the road a bit. I went to Het Nieuwsblad, so I was in Belgium for a weekend. Then I was up in Manchester and not racing.
I thought you were
going
to say I've been on the beer a bit. Then
I have been on the beer a bit. Unfortunately, went to Manchester to see my football team lose at Old Trafford, and then a day in the velodrome. Never feel terribly. I feel a bit sluggish after a few hours in the velodrome.
Try five days.
Exactly.
I think that was why I've been struggling, because it took a lot out of me.
And then I was off at the opening weekend or the first couple of days of Paris-Nice, so I need to get back into it, really.
But as Coach Chad says, you just got to get through the sessions. We're going to produce a couple of special Trainer Road podcasts for anybody interested in the training aspect of it and the story behind Trainer Road. They'll be coming out very soon. Anything else to talk about this week, chaps?
Well, I think Lionel just said he's been to Paris-Nice.
Oh, did you? Have you?
Yeah, I went for the prologue and start of the first
weekend
stage.
France.
Yeah,
weekend of Paris.
It was just the prologue was held in Conflans-Sainte-Honorine, which is I discovered that when I got there, the birthplace of Nicolas Roach. His father is Stephen Roach, of course, who married a French woman. So Nicolas Roche, as they call him on French television, got quite a lot of coverage on the day of the prologue. The prologue was won by Michael Matthews of Orica GreenEdge, and Daniel, as you pointed out on Twitter, that was his first race of the season, and making a bit of a mug of people who'd been bothering racing in January and February by rocking up and winning the prologue of Paris-Nice, taking the yellow jersey.
And Arnaud Demar won the first stage, which finished in a sprint, more sort of gravel roads, similar roads to what we saw Strade Bianche at the weekend. Demar had a pretty barren, a pretty rotten 2015 season, and Monday saw him dueling again with Nasser Bouhanni's old teammate at FDJ. Bouhanni now at Cofidis, of course. And for me, he's going to be one of the stories, could be one of the stories of Paris-Nice. Very intrigued to see how he gets on. There was an excellent documentary on French television last week on Canal Plus about Bouhanni. We all know he's a very volatile character. He's had various spats and skirmishes with other sprinters over the years. And it was just really intriguing, that documentary, about how they've built at Cofidis the train for Bouhanni. We sort of mocked it last year, didn't we? We call it the ghost train. We didn't see it at this Paris-Nice last year and a couple of other races. They just seemed to go missing. And it was very interesting, this documentary, about why that was happening, and also about how when Bouhanni joined Cofidis on a very, very big contract, about 1.4 million euros a year he's on, the best paid rider in the French peloton, about how they tried to build a train with five riders and they realised that it just didn't work, and now they've gone down to a three-rider train. Geoffroy Soupe and Borut Bozic has joined from Astana, and Christophe Laporte is also part of that train, and it'll be interesting to see if Bouhanni finally gets it right this year.
We'll watch that with interest. Lionel, anything more to add?
Well, no, we'll report properly on Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico next week. The early days of Paris-Nice are just basically riders trying to make sure they don't lose the race before they get to the proper climbs a little bit later on in the week. You know, it's quite a sketchy stage on Monday with crosswinds, very cold crosswinds, and the gravel roads, as you mentioned there, Daniel. And it will be interesting to see which of the sort of likely contenders comes to the fore. I know Team Sky have had to rejig their selections. Geraint Thomas is the undisputed leader of the team for Paris-Nice. He was going to be backed up or in tandem with Mikko Kwiatkowski, but with Mikel Landa and who's a Spanish rider?
Inchausti.
Yeah, both of them are ill. So Kwiatkowski's been moved across to ride Tirreno, and that leaves Geraint riding as a sole leader, which does, you know, you underestimate how much that changes the dynamic. Last year when Richie Porte won, it was both Porte and Thomas were able to sort of ride in tandem. So it will be interesting to see some of the main contenders going sort of head to head.
Right, we should wrap up there, chaps, because we're going to be kicked out of our little place where we are soon, I feel. We'll be back next week, as you say, to talk about Paris-Nice, Tirreno, Adriatico, and look ahead to Milan-San Remo. A little reminder that you can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. £10 for the year for 2016, and that will get you access to 11 exclusive podcasts. First two are already out. They are Behind the Scenes in the Laboratory with Chris Froome, and a special on the rise and demise of HTC High Road. I think we've got one coming up very soon, Lionel, which is your Flanders special. That sounds intriguing.
Intriguing and eclectic, yeah.
Eclectic. I like the sound of that.
See how that turns out.
Great.
It should be good.
That should be in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think we'll put that out just before the weekend of the Grand Prix Hauerbecker and Gent-Wevelgem weekend, which is Easter weekend, so a bonus.
Easter treat.
When are we doing our special on the sex lives of Italian Tour de France winners starring Vincenzo Nibali?
That's coming up later in the year, maybe around Giro time, Daniel. Thank you very much for that suggestion. Lionel, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.